Thank you. Wow, well, thank you all for coming. So as promised, I'm going to offer a little bit of my insider's view on how the media work and how we deal with science stories, and why, when it comes to science, sometimes weird stories get a lot of press. I think in light of the other journalist talk that some of us heard on Wednesday, I also want to try to make a case that some of us media types do have some redeeming qualities, and that it's still okay to talk to us. And finally, I'm going to end with a discussion of ways that I think that scientists can work with us to improve public understanding of science, and also to share the excitement of the work that you people do. So I also wanted to offer my slightly different take on what Peter said about the media mindset or media logic. I think in the best circumstances and at good publications that really people in the media are thinking about serving the general public and serving the public good. We're not really thinking about serving scientists or publicizing your work, but we are thinking about how to find information that's relevant and important to people. So when it comes to science, we're going to look for stories that have an impact on health or public policy, public funding, and environmental issues. And we're also going to look for things that we think will excite the curiosity of regular people. And we try to write stories in language that as many people as possible can understand. So why bother with science reporters at all? I've heard or seen some discussions on some blogs and websites that are run by scientists where they say, you know, why don't we just do away with these guys? They're like middlemen. Maybe the scientists should just interact directly with the public. And I have a lot of answers to that. One of them is that that suggestion is like saying, well, why not have the Philadelphia Police Department write all the stories about the police for the Philadelphia Inquirer? That, you know, the police are great and some of them are heroes, but I don't know if we really want them writing the stories. Or maybe we should have the people who make movies write all the movie reviews, in which case everybody would get 5 stars. So, actually, I put this up. This is this is not really a shiny example of the best science journalism, but I put this up. I was kind of inspired because when I go to new places and I tell people about what I do, I often tell them that I spent most of my career writing for a paper called the Philadelphia Inquirer. And sometimes people get this very shocked look on their face, and they say, "Well, you write for one of those stupid tabloids?" And I say, "No, you should know your stupid supermarket tabloid." So there is a paper called the National Enquirer, and that, as far as I know, never covers science. I think they just do celebrities and gossip. I don't really read that too much. But this paper. No, that's, now you've got it wrong. You've got it wrong. That's the weekly, that's this paper, the Weekly World News. This is the Weekly World News, separate paper, and this one actually covers a lot of science. I think it's now defunct, but I think the main purpose of this paper is really to make fun of us, to make fun of science, and to make fun especially of people like me who write about science for newspapers. And, you know, there's some discussion about whether the people who buy this paper actually actually believe what's in it. And that may...
they did the one about Bad Boy?
Oh, yeah, they did Bad Boy. Anyway, some it may depend on how hungry you are. He got kind of excited.
But people look at nature or science believe what's in it.
Well, we'll get to that. We'll get to that, because some of the weirdest stories that have come down the pike for us have actually been published in Science and Nature. They're a really good source of weird stories. So this is the Philadelphia Inquirer. This is the paper that I spent many years writing for. And actually pulled this up on Google Images. I was really pleased that it was a headline that from a story I wrote at some point, though I don't think it initially appeared way up at the top like that. I think it was on the front page, but further down, so I suspect one of those Penn Princeton people kind of nudged it up a little bit. But it should be there. It looks good there. So I thought I'd back up and just give you sort of the 5-minute version of how I fit into this picture and how I ended up being one of these media people. So I initially thought maybe I would become a scientist or some kind of a writer. I ended up doing my undergraduate work at Caltech, and I got out of there with a degree in geophysics, but not a whole lot of direction in life. Luckily, there was this really great program at UC Santa Cruz where they take people with a science degree and give us an introduction to writing. And then I sent some things to The Economist. They have an internship program there, so I tried out for that. And the next thing I knew, I was in London writing for their science and technology section. I think that experience really gave me a very positive view of the way that science writing can be. And one of the reasons for that is that I feel like there's no contradiction at The Economist between stories that are easy for anybody to read and stories that are smart. So when I hear the term, you know, dumbing down, or people say, well, do you really have to dumb stuff down? I point to The Economist and say, well, you know, anybody can understand their stories, but they're never dumb. And I think one of the reasons for that is that the writers there often have a really broad background in the arts and politics and history. And so they're able to put science stories in kind of a bigger human context. And I also think that many of the writers there don't have to rely on hype because they have wit. So unfortunately, I didn't get a permanent job at The Economist, so I had to come back to the United States. And I wrote for a short time for Science News, and then I wrote for the journal Science for their news section. I had a really interesting beat there. They let me write about particle physics and cosmology. And I really leaned on the scientific communities in those areas to get me up to speed, to teach me all the things I needed to know to be able to understand the big questions in their area. But that was the early 90s, and the superconducting supercollider was still on the table, so I got to write about the Higgs boson, what other things people thought they would find with that. When that was canceled, I wrote about the Large Hadron Collider, which people were thinking about building in Europe, and there were all kinds of exciting things going on in cosmology. People were seeing patterns in the cosmic microwave background and using that to discern things about the origin of the universe. So it was a great job. It was really exciting, but it wasn't writing for the general public, which is what I had originally sort of set my mind to do. So I was very happy to get an opportunity to join the Philadelphia Inquirer. That was 1995, and back then, the Inquirer was actually a really big, powerful paper. It had about 500,000 readers, and it had bureaus all over the world. They had a great reputation for investigative reporting. When I went to do my interview, they had a sort of whole corridor lined with pictures of people who'd won the Pulitzer Prize. So I was really excited about joining their team. But I also, now there it is. I also learned that there were some kind of weird things about newspaper culture that I didn't expect. And one of those was that you never write your own headlines. The headlines are written by somebody other than the person who writes the story. And that may seem strange, but it goes back to a time when after all the stories were written and turned in, somebody had to lay them all out on the page. And then, only then, later in the evening, did you know exactly how many characters would be in each headline. So it was kind of a word puzzle to figure out how to say something that would have something to do with the story and also fit this exact number of characters. And by the time the end of the paper was all laid out, it was pretty late, so the people who actually wrote the stories were unlikely to be either sober or awake. So it wasn't such a bad idea to have somebody else do that. The other thing I found weird about writing for a newspaper was that I would turn in stories that were pretty similar to the ones that I had written for these other publications, and they'd get bounced back by editors who would say, well, this is all very interesting, but you have to tell people why they should care. And I thought, well, that's funny, because On the sports section, they don't have to tell people in the second paragraph why you should care about football. And in the entertainment section, you didn't have to tell people why Lady Gaga or Lindsay Lohan were important. It was sort of understood. So I thought, well, it's a bit of a double standard, but it did seem like that was kind of the way that newspapers, it was the way they were structured and the way stories were structured. They actually called the second paragraph where you told people why things were important the nut graph. And I never really understood that, except maybe it makes people nuts to have to do it. And you can probably, I think that it leads to a kind of a formulaic thing that you sometimes see in science stories, where you have a second paragraph that says, if this discovery is confirmed, it will change everything about the way scientists see X field, or if this discovery is confirmed, it will lead to a cure for X disease and X disease.
We did.
In fact, we had, they still have that, though it's getting smaller and smaller and it's changing. But we had one on Mondays, the health and science section, which was really nice because then that was a home for stories that wouldn't necessarily have enough news impact to be on the front page, but were still, I think, of a lot of interest. And it also gave readers who liked science a chance to sort of look for science, though they kind of started to go further from science and more into health as time went on, and focus groups, I told them that that's what people wanted, though I'm not sure that that is really what people want. And even this, you know, this story sort of gets at this formula, because, you know, you think, well, they found heaven with the Hubble, that ought to be exciting enough, but they still have to say that the divine image stuns NASA, just to make sure people understand the impact. And also there's another piece of our formula there, that's sort of onto here, that right after that there's always some kind of quote, you know, very stock kind of quote about how exciting it's here. It's, we found where God lives, say scientists. So these guys are, yes, they are definitely onto us. But I think there are ways that I've found to sort of work within the system. And it helps to understand the different types of stories. There are a couple of different species of story that we do. And the most common one that deals with science is the feature story. And feature stories are the types that, well, it isn't about something that just happened, but it's often identifying a trend or trying to explain an emerging idea. Sometimes a feature can be a profile of a subfield of science that is interesting that people don't know much about, or an institution or a person. And another kind of feature that I think can be really important are features where a science writer tries to get the scientist's input on some area of public policy or public interest. So one example, back in the early 2000s, in the lead up to the Iraq War, there was a lot of talk about weapons of mass destruction. And that discussion was really started by politicians and policy people, but there were scientists who knew a lot about that because they were on weapons inspection teams. They had been to Iraq. And so it was really important, and more people should have done it, to have science writers interview those people and get their perspective, because they were able to bring evidence and logic to a discussion that had mostly been run by, you know, on the sort of the strength of authority. I think another type of story where it was important to get scientists involved was something, an issue called ClimateGate, which started with somebody hacking into the emails of a group of climatologists. And, you know, this discussion got out there because of mostly this sort of political type discussion. And it was, I think in that case, it was really important for science writers not only to discuss whether these guys actually did anything wrong that was exposed in these emails, which they didn't, but also to explain that the connection between human activity and climate change didn't hinge on these couple of people. But even if they were discredited, that this is something that goes way back, that there's a big body of evidence that comes from a lot of different fields. So I think it was also important for science writers to get involved and bring in different voices from different fields of science to weigh in on that. So another type of common story.
That one where a lot of the science writers felt compelled to have both sides of the story and find someone, however true, who would give the other side of the...
Some Some might have, especially because at that point, Fox News was out there. I think I didn't feel compelled to do that at all. In fact, the first story I wrote was just a backgrounder about climate change and why it rested on more than the shoulders of these people. So in order to write about it, you have to tell people, even when you debunk things, you have to explain what the bunk is in order to debunk it. So I don't consider that false balance. That's just sort of putting the issue on the table so that people understand it. So you do have to back up and say, these people were hacked and they were accused of doing all these bad things, but there's no basis to it. But I didn't feel like I was under any pressure to have to talk to people on the other side, though I did get one really interesting interview with a guy named Patrick Michaels, who's one of the few people who actually has a PhD who's in the conservative think tank world. And I asked him, well, all right, so you've got all these emails. Tell me the worst thing in there, like the worst thing that was exposed about these guys. And he'd say, well, you should just read them. There's something. And I said, no, you're the one who's making a big deal out of this. I want you to tell me what the worst thing was. And he got off the phone and he went away, and then he came back, he called me back, and he said, well, it was that Michael Mann and Phil, oh God, I can't remember his name, that these two guys had nominated each other for an AGU fellowship. And I said, well, that's not much. Like, you're really gonna create some international scandal? That's it? That's the best you got? And he kept saying, well, but don't you think that's unethical? And I said, I have no idea. It really depends on the culture of your field, but not necessarily. So sometimes you do wanna call those people just to try to pin them down, because that can be very telling. I mean, often they don't have as much to say as you would think, and especially when you try to ask them really critical questions. Okay, so weekly columns, that's where we were. So weekly columns, they are often distinguished by the fact that they show up in the same part of the paper every week, or sometimes a couple of times a week, and they'll sometimes have a little headshot of the writer, and they're written in a little different form, so usually the writers are able to use their own voice and bring in a lot of background and context. They don't have to have that, why should you care about this so much? So I've always thought that weekly columns were a great way to popularize science, to get discussions about science out there. I don't seem to have that much agreement. There aren't very many weekly science columns, and I fought with the Inquirer editors for a long time to get a science column, and they kept kind of putting me off. And finally, they did get a new editor for the Health and Science desk, and she said, okay, I'll give you a column, but I really want it to be a sex column instead of a science column. And I didn't know what to say. I'm usually more the kind of person that like needs advice about relationships than should be giving advice. But yes. Well, actually, she wasn't doing that column yet, and I had the same thought that she did, which is there's a lot of science. I mean, there's a lot of science. You could write a lot of things about why sex evolved and how sexual dimorphism came about in different species, and how sexes are here, and why are there two, and why are there sometimes more than two? So there are actually a lot of really interesting questions. So that's what I ended up doing. I ended up turning it into kind of a science column, though my hope was that they would eventually let me do a more general science column. They sort of see the light, and I could prove I was a really good column writer, and then they would let me do what I wanted. But the sex column was actually pretty popular, and so I had a really hard time getting rid of it. And I got stuck with it for like 3 years before I could finally convince them that I should do something else. And this is actually this is the logo for my second column, which was about evolution. And it was kind of a collaborative effort between me and Tony Auth, who's a political cartoonist, one of the people on that row of Pulitzer winners. And he also turned out to be a really good science illustrator, so he drew art for these columns. Actually, he still works with me for my new web project at WHYY. So this the theme was evolution, endless topics, and yes, we called it Planet of the Apes. So that was lots of fun.
So Faye, when you were at the Inquirer, how many science writers were there?
Well, there was just me for a while, but I was part of a desk, so they had me, and they had between three and four medical health writers, and then they had an environment writer. And then when I was really sort of involved in this column, they brought in someone else who did some science and some health.
Those were all full-time people?
Yeah. Yeah, so I still, even when I was writing the sex column and this column, I was still responsible for writing. If something broke in the news, I would still have to write it if it was in Science. And even if I wanted to, because, you know, it was sort of fun to jump on Science stories. And they still expected a certain number of stories for the front page. So even with these columns, there was, they keep us busy.
And how many health and science writers are there now?
Very few. There are very few, and they're doing mostly health, which is, I have disagreements with them. I had disagreements with them about how they covered health, because they thought that people wanted things that were short and snappy, but they didn't do a lot of research. So they, I felt like we were having too many little briefs and things with that were mostly, rewritten press releases and not really reported stories. I mean, health is important, and I think that it is important for us to report on things that are relevant to people's health, but the reporting is the critical thing, not just rehashing stuff. Uh-huh.
What about the online media? Is there no room for that? Do we online media?
There is, actually, which is, and I'll get to that at the end, because that's really what I'm doing now. So my artist friend and I both ended up leaving the Inquirer, and we joined the public radio station in Philadelphia, WHYY, and they have a website which is really becoming a competitor to the Philadelphia Inquirer's website. And it's kind of fun being on this sort of new upstart team and trying to build something. And so there is a lot of room. I have a kind of a hybrid. It's a blog, but I try to construct it more like a column where I do real research. And the problem is people come to blogs with an expectation that there isn't going to be a lot of background and research there. But I'm hoping maybe that'll change. So this leads to the third type of story, I think the most problematic one, and this is the breaking news story. And this image is a meteorite from Mars, and I first became acquainted with this one summer late afternoon, and I think it was 1996. I had been out all day reporting on another story, and I came back, it was about six in the evening, and there's a little post-it note on my desk, and it said, "Before you go home, can you please check into this Life on Mars thing?" And yes, and this was before you could just Google your way out of a predicament like this. So, so I had to check into this thing. I was kind of hoping like maybe it wouldn't be too big of a deal. I didn't really think there would be life on Mars, but I did have to check into it. And the final like absolute deadline is somewhere around 8:30 or 9 for stuff that's just breaking. So it turned out that in fact the journal Science, my former employer, was in fact publishing a paper by a team of people at NASA and Stanford saying there had been life in this rock, and that the rock had come from Mars, and that they had a couple of different lines of what they thought was evidence for this. And the way I really dealt with this story, I mean, these are times when I think you need kind of the literary equivalent of error bars in a story. I did know a lot of things by the time I got off the phone. I mean, I was lucky because I knew people at Science, so I could call them and say, like, "Are you really going to do this?" And they said, "Well, yeah, kind of, we're not sure how well it's going to end for us." But so I knew that they had pretty good evidence that the rock did come from Mars, and I knew that they really were going to publish this in Science. I knew where the researchers came from, so I had some information. What I didn't know was whether there actually was life on Mars. But the trick to dealing with a story like that is not to try to guess. Just tell people what you know, and then leave this vast uncertainty there. I think that that this story was actually covered pretty responsibly by most of the press, and it also gave a lot of us a really nice teachable moment, so that subsequently, because it generated so much interest, that we were able to write stories about the geologic history of Mars, sort of the question of the plausibility of life having ever arisen there, and even this really interesting question that biologists have about the fact that we have a sample size of one with life here on Earth, that we have all life had a single origin, and it would be, we'd really learn a lot, be better at defining what life is if we had some other example. So there were all kinds of really interesting stories that could be done, kind of banking off the public interest that was generated by this. Uh-huh.
Were you an active reporter during the cold fusion?
I was actually just starting out. I was doing an internship at Science News, and so I did not cover that for Science News. My colleague, I think Ivan Amato, covered it. I think he did a pretty good job. But Science News, you know, it's probably the least flashy science publication out there. You know, I don't think it suffers from the paranoid style. It's pretty unparanoid kind of magazine. So I think that they covered it pretty well. I mean, that was a real lesson to a lot of science writers that you have to be careful. Though in that case, you know, there was no major journal publishing it, and these guys were kind of out of left field. So, yeah, that was just a little before my time.
Would you talk about arsenide-based DNA story, Maureen?
Yes. Oh, that's coming next. I can't wait. Yes, that one is, because that one, in fact, I couldn't find a screenshot of our paper when this came out, so I found this one. But this story, I think, really, this is, you know, 14 years later, and I think this story was not done as well, that this did not play out well, it didn't start well, it didn't end well. From the very beginning, there was a press release that went out that said NASA was holding a press conference on a finding of astrobiological importance. And to me, this seemed like no big deal at all, because NASA holds a lot of press conferences, and they also support a whole astrobiology group. So of course, it's kind of assumed that NASA would think that the things these guys are doing for them is of astrobiological importance, or why would they even be funded? But by that point, you know, a lot of the online media was being presented by people who weren't reporters, who weren't journalists, who had no experience. And so they didn't know that NASA routinely has press conferences, or that they have a whole astrobiology group. So they just assumed that NASA had found aliens. And so this massive internet rumor went around in the day before the press conference that they were going to announce that they had aliens. And I thought, well, you know, this situation will improve when they actually have their press conference and people find out what it really is. And in fact, I think that NASA made the situation a lot worse. And I don't really know why they did this, but in their press materials and their press releases and here at this press conference, they kept talking about the shadow biosphere, which was supposedly this, you know, never yet seen other tree of life that had a separate origin and that somehow mysteriously no one had ever found evidence for. And so a lot of people that were watching this press conference or trying to report on it just assumed that this thing, this bacteria, well, actually, I should back up, right? The announcement was that they found a type of bacteria that incorporated arsenic where the phosphorus was supposed to be in its DNA. So, you know, that would be kind of interesting if it were true. It wasn't really clear it was true. That even, and it was published in Science. It was published in, yes, the same journal, right. So it was published in Science and...
Was before the publication or after the publication?
It coincided with it. Yeah. So
It did get refereed,
and I think from what I heard, the reason that it actually passed peer review is because the people who reviewed it were astronomers and not biologists. I know. Well, when you have astrobiology, you know, I guess they just thought, oh, well, let's see, I bet the astronomers will like this better than biologists. So, and they did. And actually, that was, I think, that... I know. And they didn't retract it. It was interesting, and I've talked to them about why they didn't retract it. But, you know, the reason it got such big headlines in the popular press was really this shadow biosphere thing, you know, which kind of banked off the aliens rumor. And I don't really know, that really didn't have anything to do with it one way or another, but got it out there. And as a reporter with a lot of context in the biology world, it really wasn't very hard for me to put it in perspective. I mean, just listening to this, it's like your BS detector is going off. But I called a few people and they were doubtful. I mean, the shadow biosphere thing was just silly, but they were also doubtful about the claim that they got any arsenic in the DNA at all. And so, you know, it was pretty easy for me to see what was wrong with this. But the problem here was that I think by this point, this was late 2010, that the media world had moved online and most of the people presenting science to the public were not reporters. Some of them were scientists. And some of them were grad students, and some of them were science undergrads who thought they knew what they were talking about. And I think even some prominent scientists/bloggers just bought into it because they don't know how to make phone calls and check into things.
People at this press conference were card-carrying biologists?
Well, actually, it was interesting. If you watch it's still on YouTube. I mean, she's head of astrobiology at NASA. She totally bought into it. I'm not sure if she bought into it. This is Steve Benner, who I've interviewed at length about this, and he was skeptical from the beginning. He knows this field, but he came in and he introduced himself as sort of the resident skeptic that they brought in to throw cold water on it. So people sort of assumed that, oh, well, he's what he should have said is, I'm the guy that actually knows this stuff, that I'm in this field, and I understand, I can actually tell you why this is wrong, but that's not how he presented himself. And, some of it is, it's scary to be in front of all these people. I think when he talked to the press later, he was pretty clear. But nobody should have been reporting straight out of this press conference. The way to do it is to go back and call some people. I mean, I was calling people before it was even over because it was such an annoying press conference. And people, I had people on the phone saying, oh my God, like, I can't believe that they're doing this, but they did it, and it got huge headlines. And I think most of the people who played it up were not real reporters.
Well, but I think the key issue is still that it got into science.
It got into science, not the shadow biosphere thing, though. They made this sound like it was the biggest discovery ever. I'm not sure the general public would have been that excited about a thing that a couple of arsenics stuck in its DNA.
Science also published cold fusion.
Yes. No. Science didn't publish cold fusion, I don't think. I'm pretty sure science, I'm going to check that. They may have published not the Pons and Fleischmann initial thing. I thought they published the, some of the follow-ups that where people weren't able to replicate it.
And also where they did replicate it, there were some follow-ups.
Oh, okay.
The discussion was the argument.
Okay.
And also
they published the first thing, that's Shun's opus.
Oh.
So they published Frog in addition to just Hydra's.
Hendrik Shun.
Yes.
And they published seven papers of Hendrik Shun.
But I think there are two things that are being confused here. One of which is pathological science in general, which has existed as long as science has been there. Of course, physics today did everyone a great favor by reprinting that wonderful article of Flying Mares on pathological science. And after it was published, there were people saying, no, that wasn't pathological. I still believe in it 40 years after it was disproved about many of the things. But that's a separate issue from how you present science.
And so yes.
I just want to understand what you're focusing on, which is,
this is really about the presentation of science, the way that they, I think, misled the public in, even if what they were claiming in the paper was true, they also misled the public in the press conference, in their press materials. They also created what I call a false narrative. I think maybe Peter would call it the paranoid style, but, NASA had this version of the story where the scientific community was just like too stupid and too stodgy to recognize that you could have this really exotic kind of life, and then you had this young maverick researcher come in and set everybody straight. That made a very appealing kind of tale, but that was not the press that made that up. That was the NASA PR machine, and then a lot of other people that bought into it because they thought it made for a good story.
There's a wonderful quote which is useful on this, which I think is from the editor of the New York Times, when asked if John McCarthy had a list of communists in the State Department. And he said, I try to keep an open mind, but not so open that my brain falls out.
Yes. 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 Yes, exactly. And actually, there were so many people that were doing interesting work in this general area, and so that whole narrative was just so wrong, so I think of that as the false narrative. And there really is a powerful PR machine behind a lot of these things, and they know what types of stories that, bloggers and other people will pick up. The New York Times actually covered this, and I thought they had Dennis Overby cover it, and he's more of an astronomy writer, and his story wasn't horrible. It was okay. It had some of the uncertainty, but it wasn't one of his better stories, and so that also got, I think, a little bit, he was not quite skeptical enough.
Science. by society and science. So, and PR.
Yes.
They totally confuse those two functions.
Yeah.
And therefore, the media as such becomes, you know, in a sense, like, oh,
well, it, yeah, in a way, it helps. So I think when there were more critical science writers on the ground, you know, to me, if something's published in Science, it doesn't mean it's true at all. So, you know, I...
Yeah, I'd rather the other way around, probably, these days.
So, and you know, yes, yeah, they're similar. You know, I think Science and Nature are similar in that way, in that they are incredibly prominent. They send reporters every week a little cheat sheet of all of their favorite articles, hoping that we'll, you know, kind of bite on them. So they've got their bait for us. Yes. Well, somebody writes the, yeah.
It's often most fashionable thing to say about science fiction, they're never right. But people have actually done studies on this and look at the cutting edge of research, a fair fraction of things don't turn out to be right in the end.
Yes.
That comes across many journals. And it just so happens that Nature and Science try to only publish those things.
Yeah.
I don't think that it's symptomatic of just those two journals.
Well,
Nature prides itself in not having a scientific advisory board. Chief editor of Nature.
But why is this bad? I don't understand why this is a bad situation. NASA has form publicizing and funding nutty things. They spent $15 million on the Okladnikov anti-gravity device. Arsenic as a substitute for phosphorus is not a totally lunatic concept.
No, it's not.
So the idea that you could find an organism that had arsenic, used arsenic, wasn't crazy. You don't have enough information to be able to make decisions, but it's something that the way they spin it is another question.
Yes.
But of course, they're doing it because they're a politically funded agency that has to be in the public eye in order to get money.
Right. I just think that, you know, my job as a reporter is to try to get at what's really going on and get at the truth. And when I see this, I say, okay, well, that may not be the truth. But I think because science is being reported by a lot of people who are not reporters, they just say, oh, well, if it's in, you know, if it's here, it must be true. So there's just a different approach. I mean, I don't think, oh, NASA's evil because they did this. I just think, well, there's a lot that's wrong going on here. There are a lot of things being said in this press conference that aren't true. And as a reporter, it's my obligation to find out what of this is true and what isn't and what actually happened, because that's my job as a science reporter.
But in the beginning, you promised you would tell us what we can do about it.
Yes. In fact, yes, I will get to that. And yes, okay, so I'll move past this, because we can talk about that all day. But this is the last example I'll give. This is the Higgs boson story, a pretty recent story, broke last summer. And it was actually announced that it was going to be announced on the 4th of July, which is kind of an inconvenient day for a lot of us here in the United States who want to go out and have a picnic or something. Yes, it's not here, but they should have thought, they could have thought of that. I actually offered to take my holiday and work, and I told the editors at the Inquirer, you know, I have a long history with this because I work for Science, and I've written about the Higgs boson way back in the early 90s, and so, and I had followed this big contingent of physicists at Penn and at Princeton who were involved in this work, and I said, you know, but I'm only going to do it if you put it on the front page, which is where it belongs. You know, I'm going to take my holiday off to write some story that you bury somewhere, and they came back and said, well, you know, why don't you just go enjoy your holiday? We don't really understand this stuff. You know, I don't think it's going to make the front page. So I went home and I did my thing. I actually wrote a little blog post from, I have had a science blog then in the morning, and then I went off. And then the next day, there was a huge headline on the top of the Philadelphia Inquirer. It said Higgs boson found. And I went in and I went to the executive editor's office because I was a little upset by this. It was an AP story. I didn't think it was as good as the one I would have written. And I said, well, what gives here? Why did you change your mind? And he said, oh, I heard it was the God particle. And I was really intrigued. And I guess he did not read the blog post that I had written that morning, where I'd already written a lot about the Higgs, but I kind of made fun of it. This is actually my cat, who my editor helped me name him. His name is Higgs, and he blogs for me a lot. He writes about evolution and trying to look at it from the perspective of another species. And because of his name, I also have him also write about physics. And so he's quoted in this saying that every time I hear the term God particle, I bring up a hairball. So he was actually not alone in having a negative reaction to that. I wish I could take credit for this. It made the rounds sometime that day. So, you know, some people might call this whole God particle thing the paranoid style. I think it's just sort of on the part of my editor, kind of small-mindedness and lack of sophistication. Leon Letterman.
Yeah, I know.
Not the media.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. And then he had this story that he told over and over about how he really wanted to call it the goddamn particle, and he must have told that 1,000 times. Anyway, yes, no, but I think physicists are actually a lot worse than journalists for gratuitous invocations of God and heaven in order to promote.
But there was a famous physical review letter co-authored by physicists and the cat.
Oh, really? Oh, okay. So my cat's not the only one that writes about it.
That's D.C. Bullard.
Oh, okay. Well, cats make good sort of alternative voices. And anyway, so here's the part that I promised to get to at the beginning about how you can help and how I think scientists can collaborate with us journalists. And one thing that has really been helpful to me is that I have a lot of sort of behind the scenes people. I call them sources. They could be advisors, people I really trust in different fields, so that when something happens in the world of science, I can call them and get a little bit of a reality check, often get suggestions for people I can call, or they at least give me people I can call who know people I can call. Eventually, I find my way to the people who actually know something about what's going on. And so I rely on those people a lot, and I find them all different ways. Sometimes from a story I've written, sometimes because I made a mistake in a story, and they call me and they say, you've got this wrong. And I say, well, maybe you could help me get it right in the future. And that brings me to the second point. I mean, if you see something in the paper either that you like or where there's a mistake, reporters really do want to hear from you. We want to know when we get things wrong. And my answer to people, I mean, if they don't yell at us too loud, is to say, well, you know, you could help me in the future if I write about this topic again. Maybe you could fact check my story for me. You know, I could send it to you, and you could make sure that I don't make a mistake like that, because mistakes are kind of an occupational hazard for people like me, because we deal with so many different fields of science, and we're jumping into things that we don't have that much background in. And because there are a lot of facts in science stories, there are more facts to get wrong. You look at other types of stories, really are fewer actual facts in them.
You would react positively to that, but would you say that most science writers would, or not?
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you really did make a mistake, you want to know. I mean, you definitely want to know. I definitely want to know if I made a mistake in a story. I guess if someone's just going to call and yell at me and say, you're an idiot. I mean, when I was writing that sex column, it was kind of controversial, and people would call and just yell at me and say, I can't believe you're writing about sex in a family newspaper. You know, I would just, like, scream and yell. And so that was sometimes a little disturbing. But
I'm not sure we have the experience, not directly on science thing, but having a reporter that wants to put in a quote, and I say, I want to make sure it's out of context. Can you please send me the the articles have come together out of context, and they'll say no.
Well, sometimes, now there are reasons for that. Yeah, I mean, that's tricky, though, because, say, if I'm writing a story where I've got three or four different people and they totally disagree with each other, you know, which often happens because, you know, everybody looks at things differently, and there are conflicts and controversies in science. And so if I show it to scientist A but not to B and C, well, is that really fair to B and C if they find out that A got to actually read the whole story and they didn't get to see it? So you kind of either have to show it to one or show it to everybody. And my solution is sometimes just to read back the sections, you know, over the phone that people are in. And the other solution is to find scientist D, who's not in the story at all, to read it.
But we all know the outcome of that, which is you always get mad at what somebody is said to have said in the newspaper. So a good rule is you should never blame people for what it says in the popular press, because it's always kind of...
I don't know. I mean, I usually get positive reactions from the people I quote and write about. I mean, almost always. I rarely get people mad about that. It's usually some really trivial, stupid mistake I make where I mix up something. I say A is bigger than B when I meant to say, you know, some kind of brain mistake that you make. So it's usually something really trivial, but not a misquote.
The worst thing with quoting is not misquoting, but thinking...
It's the context.
Taking one or two words on the whole.
Yeah, I actually don't like using direct quotes, and The Economist rarely uses them. And I like the fact that they rarely use them, because I think that quotes, I mean, sometimes someone just says something so clever, and it would be, you know, it would be immoral for me to take credit for it. So it really does deserve to be in quotes. So sometimes I think that there are good uses of quotes, and usually when people say something like that, they're glad to see it in the paper because they know it's clever, and they. Yeah, they're happy about that.
But there's sometimes on some of the John Pipe used to get quoted much more in newspaper than anyone else. And I was at a meeting where this person came up to reporters, and he said it was very simple. Anytime a reporter called up to ask about something, he would get a sense of what they wanted to ask about, and then he'd say, "Let me call you back in 15 minutes," and then he would think about good things that would make quotes.
Well,
it's
actually not a bad general idea, because you can do that. If someone calls you and says, "I want to interview you," you can say, not so much for quotes, but just to really think through what you want to say. You can ask all kinds of questions about what the story is about, what type of a story it is, who else is in it, what they've learned so far. I mean, reporters want to be transparent, and we don't want you to be unpleasantly surprised. We really want you to be pleasantly surprised and pleased with the outcome. Uh-huh.
So what you're telling us is how to avoid and correct wrong things that can be written or hyped up and so on. But what is I really find it difficult, really in daily life, is how to get journalists interested in good things without hyping them up, without bringing God into game.
Yes.
And how can I do that if your chief in your newspaper is some idiot that will only react if you say God?
Well, some of that is, it is a problem with front page news, and I don't work for a newspaper anymore, and some of the way I've worked around that is to have my own column, because when you have a column, then it's up to the science reporter and not up to the people that have the power. And also, now I'm at WHYY, I have my own blog, and so, I mean, blogging, it's good and bad, blogging, a lot of it isn't, it's pretty shoddy, but having a blog does give the writer a lot of power, because if I think something is just interesting, and then I can write about it, or I can write about what is interesting about the...
But this is an answer for you. I'm not a journalist, I don't have a blog. So how can
journalist
involved and interested in some good story without sex?
I think that's the beauty of having feature stories and columns.
As a scientist.
Yes.
Who would like it for a journalist to be able to...
I'm interested in it. I'll talk to you. I think what you're doing sounds really...
Identify a writer who writes a column or writes features and
Yeah, that's some of the... Yeah.
Write your own thing, it seems to me. I have this thing. it's really important. What do you think? You want to do a feature? Maybe that would be one way.
Yeah, that's one way. Also, if you do have a public relations person in, you know, in your university, you can convince them to write a press release that a lot of people, you know, if it, a lot of journalists really do see through the stupid press releases, you know, the God particle and stuff, and we are interested in interesting press releases, and I think that you know, what you do is really interesting. I could see it as a great magazine story. So,
university press people may not be able to see.
They may not be able to, they may have trouble making,
sometimes part of the problem.
They can be part of the problem, they can be, but I guess, you know, it's better to try to work with them, and because they get the word out. Also, I think the American Institute of Physics has some people that send out things that are pretty good, and that there are people I've worked with over there. There's a guy named Phil Shuey who's really good, and they actually have some really, I think the AIP has some really good people that kind of work as intermediaries between us and the physics community.
It's a legitimate question. You started out with a very promising title for all the young people.
The old people in the audience will say, we get too much press, we don't like the press we get. Most people in this audience probably are young enough, but they think about the producers. You have a great, you say, I think that's a great scheme. What scheme? So the question is here, I'm a young scientist, my department chairman comes to me and says, you know, if you're gonna get tenure, you gotta get noticed. And so now I just published a boring paper on yet another thing on Prisoner's Dilemma in PLOS ONE. And I have to write a press release that is gonna get this thing out there. And I'm totally cynical. And I wanna write a press release that is going to live up to your the promise of how you're going to help people, which is how to write a weird enough press release that people notice it, even though there isn't actually much in it. How do I do it?
Well, that's, see, to me, this is a problem with this. You know, this is, no, it's not. No, I think that there are actually responsible people, and there are good publications that would, I mean, I wrote about quantum cryptography for the Economist. So, and that story actually was very challenging for me and for the people I interviewed. I had to interview everybody involved in it like twice or even three times. So, I mean, your field is a difficult one, but it can be popularized, and sometimes it just takes a lot of back and forth and time. And I was actually really happy, and I think the scientists were really happy with the way that story came out, even though I had to pester them a number of times before we were all sure that it was accurate. Uh-huh.
Can you explain why the Economist was so
good? You know, I mean, some of it really is, it may be a cultural thing. I think it is, you know, the idea that the writers use wit instead of hype to get, and I, you know. You know, I mean, a lot of the British press actually uses a lot of hype, so they tend to be, I mean, you look at New Scientist, they have some good content, but their headlines are usually,
They often do have experts writing, and they have no scientists that write the science articles.
And they have really good editors, you know, I mean, in a way, I think the New Yorker does too, that things get sort of go through the mill, and there's also the Economist actually had something they called it boffinizing your story, and the way you boffinize a story is you send it or read it over the phone to somebody, a boffin in the relevant field, not necessarily someone who was in the story or who the story was about, but somebody else. And so that was actually part of the procedure for them. And a lot of newspapers tell you, like, don't do it, you know, don't show your story to people before. But I think for science, it's really important that you do it. And so when I came back from The Economist, I thought, well, I think I should always do it unless there's unfairness, you know, just as long as I do it in a fair way, so that if I'm covering controversy, I don't show it to somebody, you know, on one side and not the other side. But that it is really important to, and it gives you confidence, because then, I mean, I'm taking things out of the language that you're used to using and putting it in language that regular people can understand. And to do that, you know, you can do that more if you're confident that you're not screwing it up, and you get confidence by having other people look at it, and then they'll say, well, this is pretty good, you know, this one isn't quite right, and then you can take a lot more leeway of interpretation.
There's an elephant in the room that's come up a little bit, but only tangentially, and so that NASA press conference was justified by someone in the audience by saying, well, they have to get this next funding cycle, and they have to, promote this and so forth to get the funding. That might work in the short term, but long term, there are too many stories like this. The public and the Congress that are paying the bills at the NSF and at NASA are going to say enough is enough. And I've been told by friends in molecular biology that when the NIH budget doubled, the promises were we'll cure this disease, that disease, and the other disease. Those diseases are still not cured.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, the Genome Project did a, you know.
Not exactly the NIH, because the long-term promises were not kept.
Well, and this is, you know, this is where, this goes back to the beginning of my talk, where I would say that, you know, that you people and people like me in the press have some interests in common, but not completely. You know, if I'm also partly your adversary, that your goal might be to promote yourselves and get more funding, and my goal is to try to get the truth to the people, and that overlaps some of the time, but not all of the time, and so I, you know, that I addressed at the beginning.
It's a slightly different issue, which is the background of my question, namely that often we have to sex it up. We can make huge promises with this quantum information that we have, and we decided, you know, that we do not do that because in 10 years we are going to be presented a bill for this. And the problem we have is if we want to be serious and we wanted to say what it is about, which can be very exciting, very often this makes much more difficult to get attention, okay? So I want to make propaganda for my field to get more funding, but not based on God.
You want to be, yeah, you want to be responsible, and I think that's admirable, and I think that actually journalists are, you know, are going to be more likely to want to listen to you because...
Well, but there is an inverse, sometimes there is a reverse effect because kind of I don't have much experience with it, but some. So sometimes you try to talk to a person from the media, try to explain your stuff on an intellectual basis. Immediate question is how does it help solve health problems? So sometimes they provoke us to go into this kind of area because that of course beefs up the story. It's easier to say that the scientist X solved the problem and now we can cure cancer or whatever. So it's not entirely an adversary position, but sometimes it's the other way around.
Yeah.
I'm pretending that all scientists are people of integrity and all reporters are the way kind of...
No, there's a game that gets played. There's a definitely, I mean, the way...
Sometimes provoke us.
In the ideal universe, like, we would all care about nothing but truth, and so there would be no conflicts ever. But I think, you know, the question, a better question to ask is really, will this have applications, not what are the applications, because we don't really know that. And so that's kind of a loaded question, saying what are the applications of this, as opposed to...
Truth is, did you have more slides?
I'm pretty much done. I mean, the only other point I was going to make about was sort of to go to the bottom of this, which is that... you know, the other thing is just that can be really helpful for us is to consider our journalists. You know, we're sort of in the process of kind of continuing education, and that I really leaned on the scientific community when I was sort of dropped into the news section of science and had to cover particle physics and cosmology. And people actually spent a lot of time, people who weren't quoted in any of my stories, just sort of teaching me their fields. And I actually felt like I learned more doing that job than I did in college in a way, because it was like having private lessons in science, and I had the, you know, the whole community to learn from. I didn't have to worry about what grade I was getting, so I could ask just about anything. So, and I also think I was somehow a little bit more mature and in a better position to learn. And a lot of science reporters are in it partly because we like learning; it's fun for us, and so we really enjoy that. And you know, that happened again when I took on this evolution column, that I really leaned on people in the evolutionary biology community to sort of get me up to speed about some of the problems in their area and what they were thinking about. And people sort of, you know, convinced me that I really should read Darwin all the way through, which I did. And, you know, convinced me when I got to that slow part in the middle, now I keep going. You write an evolution column, you have to finish it. And so, you know, that's part of the reason I'm here, is because I think this is, you know, this is a really good opportunity for me to continue my education. And as I learn about some of these fields, like your field, that when things come up, you know, in the news that might be related, that I'll know I'll know who to call and how to turn into a news story. And it really helps me to have an awareness of what's going on. And, you know, this is another problem in journalism, that there used to be a lot of money for travel, and I used to go to a lot of conferences, and I'd go follow scientists out in the field and, you know, have a lot of direct contact, and now as money is dried up, it's a lot harder for me to do that. So programs like this are really important because they keep me from getting kind of disconnected from the scientific communities that I'm writing about.
Thank you.
sure, if people have more.
Any more questions?
Yeah, I have a more general one than Russell's about convince journalists that science is important. At some point, somebody wanted to interview me, and then I looked up this TV show, and it was about aliens landing in Peru. And I said, look, I mean, science is exciting. Why do you have to think of these things? But,
well, TV is a whole other thing, and I, you know, in a way, I think that the press gets kind of a bad rap because we get called the media, we get kind of tied in. But I don't really know the answer for television. I still think that print has some future and the web has a future in doing responsible stuff. I'm not sure about television. Some good television. My favorite TV shows are all fiction. I think it's a big outlet for.
Not what you identify.
No, never
mind. You know, I also think that people actually really do. People love science. You know, people love to go to the public lecture the other night was packed, and people really like science. The problem people have is distinguishing real science from fake science, from pseudoscience, and that's tricky because the pseudoscientists know what people want. You know, they want NASA to find heaven, or they want they want aliens. So I think that's the more difficult. People love science.
The scientists do that bit also in this connection because there's a lot of speculation about entanglement and the portal for the quantum mind and all that sort of thing. Right? So I think many of us are really overdoing better than the journalists in getting strange stories out.
Yes, yeah. I mean, though in your field, it's just. It can be difficult to understand and explain, so it's often more complex. It's actually just, it's every bit as interesting, but more complicated to get it right.
So I'm wondering about follow-up stories. So for example, your two examples, arson and life, and the Antarctic meteorites. That's not a big play, presumably front and center on science pages, but then as the evidence started to disintegrate, the stories really seem to come out.
Yes. Some of my favorite stories were those follow-up stories. I had one where I interviewed Richard Zier, who was the Sanford chemist involved, and he gave me a great interview. I mean, it was really interesting. I mean, he kind of made a U-turn from that thing just in time so it didn't tarnish him in any way. So as I saw somebody else having a little price that made him a little less vulnerable to that. But he said, you know, he got these rocks from NASA and he didn't even know what they were. You know, they just said, we want you to use your technique to get his tweet of paper that you can give us false traces of organic chemicals. So we want you to just tell us what's in these. And they were actually labeled Minnie and Mickey, and then they sent him one labeled Goofy. So, you know, he did this analysis and then he later they told him what these rocks were and he got really excited, you know, and wanted to join the team, but later as he learned more about, he ended up coming back in way more. So it was very interesting to sort of trace his, his role in all this and see how it happened. With arsenic, actually, all of my stories were negative from the beginning, so I never had to
backtrack. Well, not so much asking about you.
Yeah. But other people did sort of follow it up. I mean, I think there's ego involved sometimes. If you butt into something stupid, you don't want to have to admit to it. There were a lot of stories about both of those that came out later. I mean, they're different because the Mars rock one, just I think it's still kind of a hanging limbo. You know, nobody really disproved it. They just sort of realized that there wasn't enough evidence one way or another and just kind of hanging there. But the arsenic thing, really, I think, was put to its final resting place at this
point. Yeah, last question.
Well, I think the point that he's trying to make, though, is when these big discoveries are made, they appear on the front page. And then if it's found out that they're wrong, there's a small little retraction or description of how it really isn't this way and it appears in sections B or B.
Yes, I was
going to
say, well, journals often don't publish the negative.
I'm not faulting the press for this. I'm just saying, I think this is the frustration, is that when you see the big headline that has the this big discovery and all the hype, and then the correction
yes.
comes out,
yeah.
Just doesn't get the same. Okay.
Yeah, no, that's true, and that is why I wish all science, all newspapers had science columnists.
All right, so I want to thank Faye again. Thanks for this for a while, so it's plenty of time to